Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation. On today's show, we discuss the life and work of the late Grace Paley, one of the great masters of the short story form and a great poet, essayist, and activist as well. And there's no one better to talk Grace with than our guest this morning, Judith Arcana, author of the book Grace Paley's Life Stories. Judith, like Grace, writes poems, stories, and essays. Her work includes the poetry collections Announcements from the Planetarium, What If Your Mother, Fourth Period English, The Parachute Jump Effect, and Here from Somewhere Else, which won the 2015 Turtle Island Quarterly Editor's Choice Chapbook Award. Her story, soon to be a major motion picture, won the first Minerva Rising Prose Prize and was published as a chapbook. A longtime teacher of literature, writing, and women's studies, Judith also volunteered as a Jane, a member of the Chicago Underground Service that helped more than 11,000 women get safe, illegal abortions before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade in January of 1973. Cable listeners might know Judith from her monthly poetry show, Poetry and Everything, which airs the fourth Monday of the month at 10 p.m. Judith, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, Judith, we'll be focusing on Grace Paley for the whole hour of the show this morning, and you'll be reading for us a sampling of her work, including one incredible short story. We can call today's show Talking Grace, but since we both have an almost religious regard for her, maybe saying Grace
is more appropriate.
Yeah. She passed away 12 years ago. What's the short answer you give people who might not know Grace and her work, if people like that exist?
Well, I'm sure people like that exist, although I don't run into them as often as those who do know. Grace was, as you have actually already noted in your introductory remarks, skilled in a variety of forms as a writer, poetry, essay, short story. And the short story as a form, as a genre, as a work of art in word art, was her forte, and she was truly brilliant in the short story form. Moreover, because she was a constant, lifelong political activist, there were people who only knew her through her politics and people who only know her from the literary perspective. And when they meet, which I see frequently, they're both, oh, really? Which is very exciting, I think, to discover. Oh, she was a goddess in various forms all at once. Yes, it's true.
And you cover both in your book.
Yes, of
course. And I should
mention,
if somebody asked me that same question, I would just hand them a copy of your book.
Oh, thank you. Let's all do that, folks.
So the book itself was actually initially published in 1993.
The original version, yes.
By the University of Illinois Press, and has its origins back in 1984 when you started grad school. At that time, you decided, according to something you wrote, that you wanted to write a biography.
Yes.
And you wanted to write about a woman you admired and could learn from. So why did you pick Grace?
Well, I had already read everything she had published so far. Because when
you,
I started,
you were a big fan.
I was a big fan of her stories. I hadn't even initially known about the other stuff, but as soon as I was, you know, done with the stories, I thought more, and it turned out there were these poems and essays as well coming along. And then, because my own first two books relied on a lot of interviewing, I started thinking about what to do with my skill and experience as an interviewer. What's next? I was asking myself. And I thought, well, what if I just, instead of asking generic, you know, questions about relationships, the first two books are about family relationships, women's lives in families, etc. And I thought, well, that would be a biography, a literary biography. And then when I decided to go back to school at the age of 41, I thought, okay, well, I'll have to write a dissertation. These people know what literary biography is. And then, this is just an amazing thing, I made a very tiny list, literally three names. Grace was number one. And within a month of starting school in the fall of 1984, I saw a poster that said that Grace Paley was coming to the Chicago area.
Wow.
And yeah, it was incredible.
It was like a destiny.
Yeah, it's just the way I think about it. Yes, it was meant to happen. So anyway, I went. I had never seen her. I had never heard her actual voice, only the voice, which, as you know, is an extraordinary presence on the page.
Distinctive and unique.
I'll say, and, you know, highly skilled in terms of writing to make that happen. So I went and I thought, okay, if I think she's great, this is it. I'm going to ask her. And she was great. And so I went and got in line with the others afterwards to, they wanted autographs. I wanted her life. And, you know, I said, I want to write a book about you. And there was more to it. But at first she said no. Then I wrote to her. We talked on the phone. I sent her copies of my first two books, so she should know that I knew how to write, you know. It's not just some person who thinks she'd like to write a book about you, you know. And we started working together on the interviews and so on and so forth. She gave me entree to her people, which was incredibly generous.
I would have been terrified to go up to somebody I admired that much and ask them I'd like to write a book about you. And
well, like I said, the first thing she said was no. But oh no, she said the very first thing she said was, "That's nice, honey." And I said, "No,
which
really."
A little bit dismissive, but
for sure. And then I said, "No, I really mean it." And then this, you know, correspondence began back and forth.
But you had the courage to even ask the question, to broach it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I was there for, after all. Yeah, yeah.
Now, you mentioned that term, a literary biography, and that was actually the subtitle of the first version.
Yes.
For some reason, it's not on the reprint, the second version, which I have here on the desk. And so I want to ask, why did you call it a literary biography, and why did you remove that subtitle from the new edition?
And I can answer it easily, because I remember very well. It had the subtitle because the original publisher insisted on that. And Grace and I did not like that concept. We thought it was too limiting.
Uh-huh.
But we succumbed, and so it had that title, Grace Paley's Life Stories, : A Literary Biography. And then when I began working with Eberhardt Press, I said, take that off. Grace and I, even though of course she's no longer living, we don't want it. And he said, okay, fine.
He did not insist.
No.
Now, they're actually in the introduction, Judith. I wonder if you would read that for us. There's a paragraph that kind of explains your approach to the book, and maybe I thought maybe what would explain literary biography, but apparently that term is not one that you or Grace really are down for.
Well, we thought it was kind of limiting. I got to admit, in the main, my attitude now is a sort of a bent knee to who we were all those years ago, especially since she's no longer living and I miss her so much. But anyway, okay, so I think you mean this first paragraph of the introduction.
Oh, exactly.
Yes?
Yeah, okay. On page 23 there.
Okay, good. So here it is, folks. By translating her life into art, a writer not only saves, in Grace Paley's terms, her own life, but offers others the revelation of meaning in that life. That offering and its integral revelation are at the core of this work, which is a biographical reading of a strongly autobiographical writer. A separation of the work from the life of an artist in biographical study is always artificial and arbitrary, performed with difficulty and resulting in necessarily false distinctions. We usually make that separation for ease of handling, accepting the partition as appropriate to academic and marketing enterprises. Grace Paley is a writer whose life and work resist separation, demanding an integrated analysis of her family, her political work, and her writing.
You read so well.
Well, thank you, sir.
You could tell that you're on the radio. With me, it's like somebody walked into Cable by mistake and asked for directions to sizzle pie or something, and they sat him down in front of a mic. Sometimes I think of myself that way.
Oh, no.
Except they don't get the slice of pizza.
Well, we'll have to go out after the show. And see
it's right down the block.
I know exactly
yes.
where it is.
Now, Judith, your research for the book included several long conversations you recorded with Grace beginning in 1985. She invited you into her home and life is just amazing. In at least one instance, into her car while she was driving the back roads of Vermont. What were those conversations like? Was it a Q&A or more kind of casual, informal, like two friends talking?
Well, actually, like what I said in that paragraph about that combo, and actually even in my first couple sentences in response to your question, it was a mix, a meld, a combo. I had, of course, And remember, folks, we're talking about the early and middle and then maybe near the end of the 1980s.
Recording technology in
so,
the mid-80s.
Right. Yeah. So we're not talking about any zippity-doo-dah methods here. So I had this little tape recorder, which in the car I would balance on my knees while I read from the printed out version of the questions I wanted to ask her. Because after all, I was a professional interviewer, writer doing this, you know.
That was a cassette recorder at the
time? Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yes. So we had the cassettes, we had the recorder, we had my questions. She's driving the car. I'm trying to balance everything on my knees. I think I also had one of those little microphones with a cord that attached to the recorder.
Oh, yeah, an
so
external
I was holding
mic.
Hopefully near her mouth. Although, as I say in
yes.
the book, when I said to her, no more use of the car, it's too bumpy, it makes so much noise, and she said, no, you didn't have the mic close enough.
And she was right, you know, from a sound engineer's point of view.
I'm sure she was right. I'm sure. But, well, after all, it was such a less than excellent time and place to be recording. But anyway, we spent, luckily for me, and I'm still grateful, and a lot of time together. So if I didn't get it because of the sound or because I didn't have the mic close enough, I would talk to her some more.
And I want to get into a few of those stories, and you've already told me some before we sat down here today.
Uh-huh.
Given her reputation as a writer and activist, which is at the highest level, she comes across in the book as extremely down to earth.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. We're not talking anybody's major league ego here. That was not Grace Bailey.
No, she's not Norman Mailer.
To say the least.
Right. And there's one story you tell about how you had an appointment with her in New York, and she just asked you to delay it for a few hours because she had, quote, to go to a meeting.
Yes.
You met up later that night and went out to dinner. You were hungry. You went out for Chinese, which is pretty good in New York.
Yes.
But she never mentioned anything further about the meeting. That meeting turned out to be
an awards dinner where Grace was given an award, a major league literary award.
Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, one
yes.
of the best awards you can get for
absolutely.
A fiction writer.
Right. And she literally didn't mention it. I found out later. And I don't mean to suggest that she was deliberately keeping it from me, what I'm saying. And I think this is where you were going with this in terms of ego and the lack thereof.
Right.
It was not something she would do. Guess where I was? Or, well, I can't start on time because I have to go be honored. None of that. That would just never, you know, she was a person for whom that was not part of the list of things one would do.
It's just incredible because I looked at the list of the winners and the people who were nominated, and it's every great writer in American letters
yes.
you know, in the 20th
yes.
century.
Yeah, including Grace Paley.
Including Grace Paley, yes.
Yes.
And that was for her story collection, I should mention it, later the same day, which was published around then, 1985, 1986.
Yes, that's her third, yeah. Final collection, but she did a little bit after that. But yeah, she has three primary collections.
Now, here's another story you told me, and I've asked you to tell me it several times because it's just so unbelievably great. And this is one where you and your partner were having dinner with Grace and her second husband, Bob.
Yes.
And that was along with Ursula Le Guin.
Oh, yes, and Charles Le Guin.
Charles, her
at
husband.
At their home here in Oregon.
Yeah, in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
And I just love that story. You mentioned that after dinner, the men were, well, I make fun of it. They were having cigars and brandy in the dining room, and the women were in the kitchen cleaning up.
Well, actually, we were in the kitchen cleaning up. I don't think the guys had cigars and brandy, but your image is, of course, perfect historically.
I was exaggerating the male-female divide.
Yes, absolutely. A cultural example.
Yes.
But it was just, for me, well, I already had known Ursula as an actual human, as well as knowing Grace as an actual human, and Charles and Bob as well. For my partner, Jonathan, he knew Grace by then. The other folks were new to him. But we all played nicely together, you know, across geography and generation in a couple cases.
But what an extreme amount of talent, yourself included, intelligence and political awareness. I wish I was there.
Yeah, well, to say the least, I wish I could be there again.
I would have done the dishes very gladly.
You betcha, you betcha. And what was wonderful, and I think I may have told you this before, Ken, those of you who are listening, I probably haven't told you before, that when the three women, when we were in the kitchen, we were literally in the kitchen to deal with the dishes, and we talked. Women in the kitchen talk. We talked about things like, if you don't do them soon, then either Ursula or Grace, I think it was Ursula, said, "You can't wait too long. It's a slippery slope." I have remembered that line in that context.
You can't
context
wait too long to do the dishes?
To do the dishes, right. Because, you know, it gets scummy.
There's some stuff you'll never get off.
Well, this is women in the kitchen conversation. In this particular case, I was lucky enough to be one of the three, with the other two being Grace Bailey and Ursula K. Le Guin. But the dishes were the same woman's dishes.
Wouldn't that make a great sitcom, though?
Oh, definitely. Writers in the kitchen. I can just see it. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, after the book came out, I'm going to ask for another story here. You were asked to speak about Grace all over the country. This is a story you don't go into any details in the book, and you never told me about, but you said one of your favorite appearances was with Grace, and it was in Eugene, Oregon, at a bookstore at the time, a women's bookstore called Mother Cowley's.
Yeah.
I'm dying to know the details. You know, you just mention it in passing in the book.
Yeah. Well, I only mention it in passing because, of course, Mother Cowley doesn't exist anymore. If it still did, I would definitely have given them a big
whoosh.
Yeah. Because it was one of the, extraordinary and useful and generative women's bookstores that came out of the mid to late 20th century women's movement in the United States. The fact of women's bookstores was enormously important to writers and readers and everybody else, really, and not just women either. And Grace and I, she was visiting in Oregon, I'm pretty sure, because she was teaching a workshop as part of the, again, like the bookstore, no longer in existence, but a wonder in the same way, the women's writing workshops that used to be in Mackenzie Bridge, Oregon in the summer called Flight of the Mind.
Oh.
And Grace came to Flight of the Mind at least twice, I think three times, as a teacher for a workshop. And one of those times, I mean, I visited her with her every time she came to Oregon, of course. Sometimes she stayed at my place, etc. But I can't remember the planning. I just know we set this up. Yeah, let's do this. And so she read and I read. And I remember one of the things that happened, some customer asked her to sign a copy of my book about her. And she said, this is how good she was. She said, "No, she wrote that book. You get her to sign that book," you know. And I just thought, yes, this is yet another reason to love you, Grace Paley. Yeah, it was cool to be in Eugene at Mother Cowley with Grace. Yeah.
Now, in addition to those conversations with Grace, and they were both somewhat formal, and as you mentioned, just very conversational as between friends, you also talk with several members of her family, notably her second husband, Bob, who was in, with the cognac and the cigars with the other
in
guys.
In your fantasy,
right,
yes.
In my fantasy, yes.
Yes, the guys.
And her daughter, Nora, and her son, Danny.
Yes.
Assuming that Grace smoothed the way for these conversations and she didn't try to resist you getting additional information.
Oh, not at all. She actually, I was even there on a couple of occasions when she called people and said, "She's here. You can talk to her. I'd like you to talk to her," or "feel free to talk," whatever, phrases of that nature, to her children, her husbands, both of them, and to some good friends, people who had known her for decades, people who had been active with her in the peace movement and other heavy-duty political stuff that she had been doing all along. And they did, because she said so. And I remember some of those experiences quite well. Those people were good to me, and they were good to me because Grace said, "Talk to her."
And it also shows she must have been extremely well-respected and loved by those around her, her family and her friends.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Even her ex-husband.
Somebody said to me, I did a gig recently, actually here in Portland, talking about this book. I mean, the book that I wrote, Grace Paley's Life Stories, and about Grace. And someone said to me, and there's a big Q&A, a lot of people had many, it was wonderful. You know how great it is to have a Q&A in a crowd that's enthusiastic. And someone said to me afterwards, "Was there anybody that didn't like her?"
And of course, wondering the same thing.
Turns out, yes, because this is the real world. Uh-huh. And I can't say I encountered a whole lot of them, but I do remember looking, because I already, I was smitten instantly, and of course had always admired the work even before I met her. But I did find one seriously critical essay, which was called A Descent on Grace Paley.
Based on her fiction?
Based on her fiction. And, you know, it's been a while since I read it. It may also have been political because it was published in a fairly conservative journal.
Oh, okay.
And it's in the bibliography. I wouldn't leave it out, you know. And I think that there were other people who didn't love Grace because, like I said, it's the real world. But most people who encountered her and or her work found much to admire and took delight in her and or her work.
That comes across in the book. She's just very likable. I was going to say that probably Richard M. Nixon wasn't a big fan.
I think you might be right. Now, I didn't interview him.
No, fortunately. But she was very anti-war and visited Vietnam, Hanoi, and several places during that era.
Definitely.
Now, someone who reads her stories and studies her life can see quite a few connections between the fiction and the autobiographical elements. In fact, there's a recurring character based on Grace herself, and she appears in about a third of the 45 collected stories.
Yeah.
Her name in the stories is Faith, you know, Grace Faith.
Grace Faith,
Darwin,
right.
Asbury.
Yes.
And you write that it's a question you ask Grace directly. Are the stories autobiographical? She replies, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I wrote my life into the stories. Don't you see the difference? What's the difference as you see it?
Yeah, well, at first I said, maybe I don't, you know. But I think really, I mean, at this point, what I think that she meant was I was not deliberately trying to write my life story but change it enough to make it fiction. I was making up stories and I was drawing them from what we all have when we're making art of any kind, which is our lives. Now, those are my words, but that is my understanding of what she meant. And I think it makes sense. I mean, for instance, the character Faith, who I definitely consider a relatively autobiographical creation, has two children, as Grace did, but they are both boys. Grace had a son and a daughter. And while we might say, oh, well, that's not such a big difference, actually, it is. It's quite different to be a mother of two boys and raising them up into men in a misogynist culture than to have a boy and a girl and to have to deal with the differences and so on. That's a different, literally a different story.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think that's what she meant, or something like that is what she meant.
Now, the book came out when she was still alive, obviously.
Oh, yes.
You went on reading tours,
yes,
and that
yes.
was you know, published in
1993. In the early 90s, yeah.
She was in her early 70s at the time. She was born in 1922.
22, right.
Okay. Did she tell you her impressions of it, or just kind of stayed out of it?
Well, that's very interesting. People ask me that a lot, as you may imagine. She never once said to me, she certainly never said there was anything she didn't like. She would have done so. I know it because there's no doubt in my mind. I mean, if she didn't like what I was doing, she would have stopped it, you know? So that I know. As for actually, I sent her the complete manuscript before I sent it to the publisher. She never said there was no naysaying. I think there was almost no saying. At one point in that set of weeks, and I sent everyone that I interviewed that I had transcripts of, copies of their pages, the pages in the book where they were quoted.
Oh, they can approve.
So that they could, exactly. And no one said anything to me about those either, although Grace called me and said that her daughter was unhappy with something someone else that I interviewed, a friend of Grace's,
had said
about her father.
Oh, her father.
Yes, which is Jess, Grace's first husband. Mm. And she said Nora was unhappy about this. And I said, okay, it's out. Because, first of all,
even
to
though
me,
it
was.
Even though it could have been true, it was.
Sure. But it was actually, it's not even a question of truth. This guy had an opinion of Jess, and it wasn't a flattering opinion.
And his daughter
And
took,
his daughter took offense.
Right.
And that's it, you know? And this was not, people say to me, you took it out. I say, yeah, it was not important, you know? That kind of thing. It's like the level of gossip. What do I care? And that is literally the only thing she said until the University of Illinois Press, 6 or 7 years later, whenever it was, decided to take the book out of print. And when I told her that, and this is burned into my brain, she said, oh, people love that book. And I thought, ah. I know what that means. You approve.
I would take that as a sign of approval.
I definitely took that as a sign of approval. Yeah, years later, but okay, I'll take it.
Now, I want to get a little bit into her bio, though we don't have a whole lot of time to do that, and that's a good a reason for people to read the book. We mentioned some of the autobiographical aspects and some of the things that were not quite the same as her real life.
Right.
And like a lot of stories these days, Grace's own life story had its beginning in the Ukraine.
Yes, I think about that a lot.
Right. It just seems to pop up every now and
then. Really? Talking about the Ukraine 30, 40 years ago was different than talking about the Ukraine now. Yeah.
Right. And that was actually the birthplace of her parents. So that was turn of the century, the 20th century.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little background of her parents' life there, where Grace came from and how they went from the Ukraine to New York City? And I know the Tsar's involved in there somewhere in a prison camp in Siberia. It's quite a story.
Yes, and it's, alas, a common story of that time, and not particularly unusual in this time, even though there's no Tsar anymore, typically, literally, or whatever. Anyway, her parents were political young people in their late teens and early 20s, and her mother was, I think they would have used the word banished, to Germany, and her father was indeed sent to a work camp in Siberia for their political activities. And then the Tsar... His wife had a child, probably a male child, because this would have made him happy, mm-hmm. happier than if it were the second rank right. kind of child. And he pardoned everybody. And as soon as they came back, they were, sponsored to leave the country immediately by grandma, which is to say her Grace's father's mother saw to it that they could leave, and they went to the United States. They had the Ellis Island experience. And then they were able to bring that grandma and other siblings and later cousins and so on to help bring them out and save them in
those
years.
And her original family name at that time was Goodsight.
Yes, Goodsight.
Which they changed to Goodside.
Goodside.
And what was remarkable to me, amazing about the story, is her father came here and actually settled in a few years and went to med school and worked as a doctor the rest of his life in New York.
Well, not actually the rest of his life. He worked as a doctor for a few decades.
Uh-huh.
And then, right around the time her mother died of cancer that had spread from breast cancer to various other parts of her body and then killed her fairly rapidly at that point. But her father, at that moment, stopped practicing medicine. And his children and his other people said, no, don't, what are you doing? I think they thought that he was slightly deranged from grief and stuff like that. But he stopped practicing medicine and began painting. And I have actually seen that man's paintings. He was pretty good.
Wow, what an artistic family.
Yes, they were a skilled little bunch. Still are the ones who are of the next generations. So he didn't practice medicine for the rest of his life, but he certainly did for a few decades. He learned English quite quickly. The story is that he read a lot of Dickens, which I think is very funny, because if you're in the United States and you're reading 19th century Charles Dickens, oh, really? Is that the way you're going to talk to your parents? Or excuse me, your patients and your... But whatever, he did a good job with it. And they, the women, and it was all women, the wife, the mother, the sisters... They all worked and worked and worked and sent him to medical school and supported the family financially. And then when he was done, he graduated, he began practicing medicine, and then he was able to bring in money as well.
Now, unfortunately, as I said, we don't have time to go through much more of Grace's life, but I want to touch on how she started writing stories and the conditions she was working under. This was like in the early 50s, so post-war U.S.
Yes.
She was a wife, a mother, there's also some remarkable coincidences that led to her first publication. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think about that all the time. As a writer who, has to hustle, like most of us, to get published, I think... Geez Louise, what a shot she got.
It's like Grace coming to University of Illinois, right? When you were thinking about writing
right,
a book.
Right, being in Chicago.
Destiny.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what happened was she had written, maybe three or four stories. And I think that at least two of them had been published in magazines at that point. I got to admit, I haven't got the you know, the exact years and publications. They're in the bibliography, folks.
It'd be mid-50s, something like
oh,
that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. That's when it was happening. I mean, I can't remember exactly. This story came out in this year. This story came out in that year. In any case, she had these stories. And both her husband, Jess Paley, and her dear friends were saying to her, Grace, you should have a book. You should. And she didn't take action. She was busy, you know, learning how to be a political activist even more than she already was. And because she started in high school at age 15. And it turned out that her kids were in an after-school childcare situation with some other kids whose father was an editor at Doubleday.
Yes, can you believe that?
That's amazing, amazing. And so somebody, I don't think they asked Grace, whoever it was, I'm pretty sure it was one of her friends, gave him the story, gave his wife, who was the one minding the kids, like the women in the kitchen, you know, and she gave them to him. And he said to Grace, write 6 or 7 more and we'll make a book.
Well, in the book, which I've read very recently, so, but another part that is just amazing is he was coming, he was divorced and he was coming to pick up his kid.
Yes.
And he had to wait a little and he just picked up the story.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even...
I think the ex-wife had put them out for him, but I don't know.
Okay. It just seemed very coincidental that he picked them up, read them, and then just said...
Well, I'm sure that if he hadn't had to wait, that wouldn't have happened.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so that, for sure, is right up there with the, ooh,
right,
oh my God.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, I think we should give listeners a taste of Grace's fiction. No better way than to have you read one of the stories, and you very graciously, a pun unintended and not all that good, is a you chose one that's a good illustration of her voice, the autobiographical elements we talked about, her politics, her humanity. And unfortunately, it just happens to be as relevant today as when Grace wrote it. It's called The Immigrant Story, and it's from her second story collection, which came out in 1971. That's called Enormous Changes at the Last Minute. I have to tell listeners, for broadcast, we had to beep a few words, but these will be restored for the archive audio on the KABU website if you want to hear what those words are, if you can't guess from my beeps.
My guess is they'll be able to guess. So this is The Immigrant Story, written by Grace Paley some years back, but as Ken says, definitely on point in the moment. Jack asked me, isn't it a terrible thing to grow up in the shadow of another person's sorrow? I suppose so, I answered. As you know, I grew up in the summer sunlight of upward mobility. This leached out a lot of that dark ancestral grief. He went on with his life. It's not your fault, if that's the case. Your bad disposition is not your fault. Yet you're always angry. No way out but continuous rage or the nut house. What if this sorrow is all due to history? I asked. The cruel history of Europe, he said. In this way, he showed ironic respect to one of my known themes. The whole world ought to be opposed to Europe for its cruel history, Jack, and yet in favor of it because, after about 1,000 years, it may have learned some sense. Nonsense, he said, objectively. 1,000 years of ongoing, persistent imperial cruelty tends to make enemies, and if all you have to deal with these enemies is good sense, what then? My dear, no one knows the power of good sense. It hasn't been built up or experimented with sufficiently. I'm trying to tell you something, he said. Listen. One day I woke up, and my father was asleep in the crib. I wonder why, I said. My mother made him sleep in the crib. All the time? That time, anyway. That time I saw him. I wonder why, I said. Because she didn't want him to fuck her, he said. No, I don't believe that. Who told you that? I know it, he pointed his finger at me. I don't believe it, I said. Unless she's had 5 babies all in a row, or they have to get up at 6 a.m., or they both hate each other, most people like their husbands to do that. Bullshit! She was trying to make him feel guilty. Where were his balls? I will never respond to that question. Asked in a worried way again and again, it may become responsible for the destruction of the entire world. I gave it 2 minutes of silence. He said, misery, 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 grayness. I see it all very gray. My mother approaches the crib. Shmuel, she says, get up, run down to the corner and get me half a pound of pot cheese. Then run over to the drugstore and get a few ounces cod liver oil. My father, scrunched like an old gray fetus, looks up and smiles at the bitch. How do you know what was going on? I asked. You were 5 years old. What do you think was going on? I'll tell you. It's not so hard. Any dope who's had a normal life could tell you. Anyone whose head hasn't been fermenting with the compost of 10 years of gluttonous analysis, anyone could tell you. Tell me what? He screamed. The reason your father was sleeping in the crib was that you and your sister, who usually slept in the crib, had scarlet fever and needed the decent beds and more room to sweat, come to a fever crisis, and either get well or die. Who told you that? He lunged at me as though I was an enemy. You fucking enemy, he said. You always see things in a rosy light. You have a rotten, rosy temperament. You were like that in sixth grade. One day you brought 3 American flags to school. That was true. I made an announcement to the sixth grade assembly 30 years ago. I said, I thank God every day that I'm not in Europe. I thank God I'm American-born and live on East 172nd Street, where there is a grocery store, a candy store, and a drugstore on one corner, and on the same block, a shul and 2 doctor's offices. 172nd Street was a pile of shit, he said. Everyone was on relief except you. 30 people had TB, citizens and non-citizens alike, starving until the war. Thank God capitalism has a war it can pull out of the old feed bag every now and then, or we'd all be dead. Ha ha. I'm glad you're not totally brainwashed by stocks, bonds, and cash. I'm glad to hear you still mention capitalism from time to time. Because of poverty, brilliance, and the early appearance of lots of soft hair on face and crotch, my friend Jack was a noticeable Marxist and Freudian by the morning of his 12th birthday. In fact, his mind thickened with ideas. I continued to put out more flags. There were 28 flags aflutter in different rooms and windows. I had one tattooed onto my arm. It has gotten dimmer, but a lot wider because of middle age. I am probably more radical than you are nowadays, I said. Since I was not wiped out of my profession during the McCarthy Inquisitions, I therefore did not have to go into business for myself and make a fortune. You damn fool. Plenty are wiped out to this day. I mean, brilliant guys, engineers, teachers, just broken, broken. I believe I see the world as clearly as you do, I said. Rosiness is not a worse window pane than gloomy gray when viewing the world. Yes, 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 he said. Do you mind? Just listen. My mother and father came from a small town in Poland. They had 3 sons. My father decided to go to America to 1, stay out of the army, 2, stay out of jail, 3, save his children from everyday wars and ordinary pogroms. He was helped by the savings of parents, uncles, grandmothers, and set off like hundreds of thousands of others in that year. In America, New York City, he lived a hard but hopeful life. Sometimes he walked on Delancey Street. Sometimes, like a bachelor, he went to the theater on 2nd Avenue. Mostly he put his money away for the day he could bring his wife and sons to this place. Meanwhile, in Poland, famine struck. Not hunger, which all Americans suffer 6-7 times a day, but famine, which tells the body to consume itself. First the fat, then the meat, the muscle, then the blood. Famine ate up the bodies of the little boys pretty quickly. My father met my mother at the boat. He looked at her face, her hands. There was no baby in her arms, no children dragging at her skirt. She was not wearing her hair in 2 long black braids. There was a kerchief over a dark, wiry wig. She had shaved her head like a backward Orthodox bride, though they had been serious advanced socialists like most of the youth of their town. He took her by the hand and brought her home. They never went anywhere alone except to work or the grocers. They held each other's hand when they sat down at the table, even at breakfast. Sometimes he patted her hand, sometimes she patted his. He read the paper to her every night. They are sitting at the edge of their chairs. He's leaning forward, reading to her in that old bulb light. Sometimes she smiles just a little. Then he puts the paper down and takes both her hands in his, as though they needed warmth. He continues to read. Just beyond the table and their heads, there is the darkness of the kitchen, the bedroom, the dining room, the shadowy darkness where, as a child, I ate my supper, did my homework, and went to bed. Yeah, she's something.
Yeah, and still very relevant.
Oh, yes. That's part of it, you know? If you write something and it's wonderful, but then in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, it's irrelevant, then how wonderful could it have been, you know? It was a moment's flash across the sky.
Though yeah. You kind of wish it was irrelevant.
Really?
In this case.
Yes, yes.
We talked so far about Grace's life and her writing, and it was wonderful for you reading that story. Now, she was also, I think we touched on it, she was a longtime teacher of writing, and she taught at Sarah Lawrence College. That's in Bronxville, New York, so just a little north of the city itself.
Yes.
And you have a great section in the book on how she taught writing, which also explains a little bit about her own writing process. I tell you, it's like getting a free masterclass in writing for those of you not just interested in Grace and how she did her stories, but maybe you're writers yourselves. Judith is going to read this section, and this is from her book, The Grace Paley Life Storybook.
Okay. In 1970, the year in which she received an award for short story writing from the National Institute for Arts and Letters, she contributed, quote, some notes on teaching probably spoken, end quote, to Jonathan Baumbach's anthology, Writers as Teachers, Teachers as Writers, listing about 15 things she might say in the course of a term. I want to interrupt myself here to say Grace did not graduate from college. Grace barely graduated from high school. And I'm not saying, when I say barely, it's because she was dumb. Clearly, you
clearly
can see
not.
She was not.
Yes.
She couldn't get into it, you know? She kept trying to do it because she knew she was supposed to, but it didn't take. And I like to tell people that because now everybody thinks you got to get an MFA, you know? Apparently not, folks. Okay, back to the book. Among those things is a recurring emphasis on the writer's consciousness of language. She emphasizes the importance of, quote, the language that comes to you from your parents and your street and friends, end quote. Of course, this emphasis is a result of her own discovery that literature could be written in one's real voice and could then move into the voices or language of others. In this essay, the one I'm talking about here in the book that I wrote, she writes that she would ask her father to tell her stories and that she tries to remember her grandmother's stories. She urges her students to do the same, asserting that, quote, because of time shortage and advanced age, neither your father nor your grandmother will bother to tell you unimportant stories, end quote. She entreats students to be open and to remain ignorant. She warns them to remove all lies from their work, naming, like the recitation of plagues at a Seder, the lie of injustice to characters, the lie of writing to another's taste, the lie of the approximate word, the lie of unnecessary adjectives, and even the lie of the brilliant sentence you love the most. And that is, and everyone who's listening who is a writer, you know how tough that is. You just think it's so cool and you don't want to take it out. And Grace is saying, you know what? Maybe you should.
That's the old kill your darlings.
Yes, it's that kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's more, but I don't know how much, you know, more. Shall I read a little more of this section?
No, I think that's the important part is kind of reading your stuff aloud. And, of course, with her, it works perfectly because she's got that very distinctive voice.
Yes.
You kind of showed us that with the immigrant story that you read for us.
Yeah.
I want to get a little bit, Judith, into the second edition.
Okay.
And that was thanks to Eberhardt Press.
Yes, here in Portland, Oregon.
And the modern miracle of crowdfunding. Can you tell us about that story? So it's, like I said, originally published University of Illinois Press, so about, 26 years ago or so.
Something like that.
And then it came out again in the second edition from our local publisher, Eberhardt, just about a year ago.
Yeah. Eberhardt is... I would say not just a small press, but a tiny press. And so it's like all such enterprises, and again, some of you listening may know exactly what I'm talking about. For others, guess what? This is true. And so they're on the edge. The press is on the edge sometimes. And what with gentrification and having to move and blah, 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 lots of other ordinary, all too ordinary situations, sometimes it's necessary, particularly with a book. I'm so happy with the look of the book. You know, I think Charles Overbeck, who is the publisher, editor, designer, etc. at Eberhard Press, I gave him a bunch of pictures. I gave him a whole bunch of stuff. He designed it. He chose what was going to be on the cover, what was going to be on the back cover, what was going to be inside, and so on. And he needed more money than he actually had in the till, should there actually happen to be one at a small press, and so had a Kickstarter to get enough money for the kind of paper that he wanted for this wonderful, smooth, and cleverly designed cover with flaps.
Oh, it's a work of art. That the cover, it's almost like a dust jacket on a paperback.
Yes, exactly. That's just what I think of it. And with these flaps so that the blurbs and the comments from people could still be right there. Anyway, and it really just hit the ground running and took off and, in fact, went over the whatever they call
the goal,
the required number, and got a little more, even maybe another 1,000 or nearly another 1,000. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I don't take that personally. I think that's about grace, you know. People wanted this book about Grace Paley to come back. And
this was not the GOP buying up all of Don Trump Jr.'s book. This was a whole bunch of people giving smaller amounts.
Definitely. A couple people gave some nice big amounts. But yes, absolutely, absolutely. And needless to say, this made me very happy. And it certainly made Eberhard Press and Charles Overbeck pretty happy, too.
Yeah. Now, the first edition and the second edition both cover about the first 66 years of her life.
Yes.
So 1922 to about 1988 or so. Mm-hmm. And since she was alive at the time, you write in the book that many of the chapters are in present tense,
yes,
rather than make it seem like she had passed away. Uh-huh. So I was wondering why you kept the present tense in the uh-huh. book. And also, were you considering at some point extending her story up until her death in 2007 uh-huh. from 1988?
Okay, so let me just deal with the first part pretty quickly.
Two disparate questions, but I tend to do that.
Right, yes. Well, don't we all, because, you know, unless we're writing for science magazines. I decided, and I thought it through exactly the way you're asking the question, and decided to keep the present tense because I wanted the vibe, the feeling of what it was when I was writing while she was alive. And I just, you know, it's my book. I could decide. I wasn't working with the kind of publisher who tried to make me do things that I didn't want to do. On the contrary. And so I thought, okay, I'm doing this. Also, all the years in between, I kept thinking other people were going to, you know, lots of times with really important and valuable writers, there are many books. And there hasn't been another study of the life and work of Grace Paley to do those 20 years that I wasn't writing about. So I thought, come on, people, get with it. Now I'm an old person and I got other business.
Right.
Well, anyway, so the upshot of that part was that I went through, of course, I read it a few times. I hadn't read the whole book in years. I had read bits and pieces. And so I read the whole book. I thought, one thing was such a relief. I thought, hey, this is pretty good, you know, and that was a relief. But then I went through again to edit, not to change from the present tense, but to just change whatever things seemed politically, culturally, sociologically, somehow to need a little, you know, some kind of...
A little explanation?
Yeah, a little explanation or a little... Just sometimes it only took a few words. And so I did that here and there. Plus, I added a brand new preface, which explains more about, you know, why a second edition and so on, and Grace's relevance in our time and so on. And I think it does well. And I believe that if there are publishers in our future, if there are books in our future, if there is a future, I'm an apocalyptic thinker, folks, then there will be more books about Grace. That's bound to happen.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, her work will stand the test of time.
Oh, unquestionably.
And people will be curious about those last 20 years of her life.
Yes.
What
yes.
happened?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was able to put in a little bit here and there in the new preface, but anyway, yeah.
Now, one extremely important aspect of her life we didn't get into in much detail yet, and that's her activism.
Ah.
I mentioned it here and there, the anti-war. She was also very pro-choice and anti-war during the time of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, pro-choice around the Roe versus Wade, late 60s, early 70s, when you were in the Janes
yes.
in Chicago helping people get, at that time, illegal
right, this is before
abortions.
We knew each other and we were doing this.
Yeah. How did Grace herself see that role? It just seemed like just a regular part of her life. She didn't really separate the writing from the activism from the teaching.
No, on the contrary, and to the dismay of the more literary types, often lovable good friends, Grace, I do say, spent more of her time and energy on her politics. And people would say, so how come we have to wait so long between books? And when's the next one coming? And she would say, sweetly, of course, you know, I got some other things to do here. and, you know, other things included sitting down in the middle of streets in New York City with, you know, 10 or 100 people so that tanks could not go somewhere that they wanted to go, or marching around a particular place, or every week or weekend for, I think it was 8 or 9 years, leafleting and doing solitary representation for the peace movement. Grace was one of the people that the peace movement chose to send to Vietnam during the war for a prisoner exchange that they arranged. Not the U.S. government. The U.S. government had nothing to do with this. The peace movement people were in touch with the North Vietnamese people. My people know your people, that kind
right.
of thing.
No, I was surprised in the book that she actually went to Hanoi.
She went
that
to
time.
Hanoi and arranged, was one of two or three people. It was not just Grace. It was a small team of peace activists, or peaceniks, as they were called in the time, and brought back some of the pilots who had been held in prison there. And as soon as they came to the States, of course, the government and the military sort of gobbled them up, took them away from the peace movement people who had brought them
back. So they couldn't make
back.
A point about
exactly.
how much effect they had
right.
and how the North Vietnamese were being very cooperative.
Yes, exactly. Or anything about the peace movement's role in actually making this happen, bringing these guys, and they were, of course, all guys, home. Yeah. So that's extremely notable, of course, but all the time, whether it was a nuclear power plant, whether it was the restraint or the forbidding of abortion access and contraception, for goodness sake. Grace was in the streets, is the line, the description, and in her case, as in the case of many others, it's literally the fact. It's not a metaphor. They were in the streets, marching, talking, and she was arrested many, many times. And I'm not saying there was no cost. Her children were frightened or angry and, you know, irritated by the fact that their mother was not available when they wanted her. You know how children are, even grown children, old children. I want you now.
Mom,
you know.
Arrested again?
Yes,
grow
really,
up. Yeah.
Really. Although her daughter had this wonderful, and it's in the book, I talk about it at some length. Her daughter told me about when the Women's House of Detention was right there in the city. It was just a block or so from their apartment. And so she had always seen people on the street yelling and waving up. And she was so excited that she could do that now because her mother was up there.
Wow.
And yeah, so it's not like the kids, either Nora or Danny, thought anything was wrong or bad about what Grace was doing. On the contrary, it's just that they wanted her to be, as all kids do, their person. And she was being a person for other people, lots of them.
And that just didn't come across only in the stories, but she wrote several essays. We won't have time for it, but you had mentioned the essay about some history on Karen Silkwood Drive.
Yes, that's about the
nuclear plants.
The nuclear plant being built in New Hampshire, which, of course, was built. And then they won, the good guys won on the second time around when the military wanted to enlarge it. So they were able to stop that. But I think Seabrook is still operating. However, we've had better luck. If Grace were here now, she would have been at the pipeline stuff. She would be there now. And so there's been some good action around
there'd
the pipeline.
There'd be plenty for her to do.
I'll say.
So it was anti-war. It was universal health care. It was pro-choice. It was the environment.
Yes.
She was extremely active, and she didn't really say, okay, I'm a writer, so I've got to write, and this is kind of my secondary career,
right.
I do in my spare time. Wasn't anything like that.
No.
Each of her roles were
yes,
primary.
Yes, she definitely thought that both of the kinds of work that she was doing were of some value, not only to herself but to others. That was part of why she wanted to do them. And if she were forced to make a choice, she would choose to be in the street rather than at the keyboard.
Were you ever with her on a demonstration?
I don't think so. Once we went somewhere, maybe it was a vigil, but no.
So that Vermont trip was not to visit a nuclear plant?
No, I visited Bob in Vermont a few times. She came to Chicago and visited me. There were other things happening, you know, that we were doing together, but no. That would have been cool, man, if I could have been,
right.
You know, along with her, as many of our mutual friends were.
Well, it's a wonderful book, Judith.
Thank you.
I learned a lot, and she's just somebody people should know more about if they don't already. And not just the fiction, as we talked about her teaching and her activism.
Yeah. Her activism was also teaching.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, where can people pick up the book and learn more about your other work?
Well, people can go, first of all, to my website, juditharcana.com. And
I don't know how you got that URL. I could get kenjones.com.
And there's, of course, surprise, surprise, a writing page. And all of the books, all of my books are there. You just click on the book cover, and then you can, you know, learn, you can get it, whether you're in Oregon or not, you can get it directly from the publisher. Just have it sent to you the way everybody does with everything except fresh eggs. I hope they're not doing fresh eggs that way. But anyway, you can also tell your local neighborhood bookseller to order and stock it.
Well, Judith, again, thank you for coming into the neighborhood this morning. You've had such a long, productive career also as a writer, teacher, and activist, which coincidentally mirrors the career of Grace Paley. I hope one day we see a book titled Judith Arcana's Life Stories.
Oh, aren't you wonderful? Thank you, Ken.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show or would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. That's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. A big neighborhood thank you to Judith Arcana, author of Grace Paley's Life Stories, for joining us in the KABU studios. You can learn more about Judith, her book, and all her work at juditharcana.com, and I don't know how she got that URL. And you can learn more about the amazing Grace Paley by reading her fiction, poetry, and essays, which are available at libraries and wherever good books are sold. Can't leave without giving a big thank you to our engineer in the air room, the inimitable, unparalleled, and scholar with an encyclopedic knowledge of American animated television shows, Sonia Buttrell. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope it's always a beautiful day in your neighborhood.